Well, I'm so glad to see you tonight. I appreciate this opportunity this week to be with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed this week, and I appreciate the invitation and hope that all of us have been profited by our time together. We've been studying on this week the Christianity 101, a lifestyle of a disciple, and we've looked at various things that constitute how a disciple should live his life. In the sermon that I'm going to talk to you about this evening, we're going to look at an area of service as we seek to live out our Christianity. And it's called the service of refreshment. And so we want to look at what a refreshing Christian is. You know, as we interact with others, we need to be a cool oasis in another's hot desert. We need to be one who lifts up rather than pushes down and just sucks the life out of other people. To learn how to be a refreshing Christian, I want to study this evening the life of an unknown individual. His name almost sounds like a misprint, Onesiphorus. And while you may not be very familiar with him, I can assure you that he was known by the Apostle Paul. I love the life of this man as I've studied his life. He's one of my all-time favorite characters in the Bible. 3 points this evening. Number one, I want you to see the difficulty of the confinement. We're going to look, first of all, at the dungeon. The Apostle Paul had been imprisoned in the latter chapters in Acts in the early 60s. He was there in Rome. But he was released, and probably the reason he was released is because Nero wanted the accusers to come and set a case against Paul, and apparently they never showed up because they knew they didn't have a case. Later on in 64 A.D., a great change occurred in Rome's thinking toward Christianity. The great fire in Rome occurred, and the Romans were blaming Nero. And so he made the Christians a scapegoat, and he persecuted them terribly in the next few years. Since Paul had already been in prison there in the city of Rome, it would be very easy to trump up the charges against him. And so his second imprisonment began at about 67 to 68 A.D. It was at this time that the Apostle Paul wrote 2 Timothy. The second imprisonment is much more severe and restricting than the first imprisonment that we see in Acts 28. This imprisonment, as compared to the first one, many friends visited him in Acts 28 and other passages in the epistles. But in this second Roman imprisonment, there's virtually none who visited him. Many opportunities to evangelize were seen even there in Acts chapter 28. But now, in this final area of his life, the opportunities for evangelism is restricted. And he was optimistic for his release and freedom when you read the epistles and the book of Acts. But in this particular imprisonment, he anticipated not his freedom, but he anticipated his execution. Every time you read the book of Second Timothy, you must remember a dungeon. This is the famous Mamertine prison in Rome, where some think that Paul was confined, and this was one of the worst prisons there in Rome. Whether it was the exact location where Paul was, it gives us a pretty good idea of what the prisons would look like in that day and time. It was sunk 12 feet underground, but originally it was a cistern. And then it consisted of two rooms above one another with iron shackles fixed to the wall. And the top room is called the carcer. Means prison. It's where we get our word incarceration from. And then the bottom, the lower room is the tuli enim, and so prisoners were brought and they were lowered into this area in an opening the size of a manhole. And here you can see that hole up above there, and here's some other pictures that they've taken, and you can just imagine how confining that would have been. This manhole was the only entrance and exit to the dungeon. And so behind this moving letter, we need to visualize the Apostle Paul, the aged, languishing in this dark, damp, and cold dungeon in Rome, from which there would be no escape. The very next event in his life, after standing before the Emperor Nero, would be death. It doesn't take a great deal of imagination to consider the emotions of Paul at this particular time. He is alone, he is feeling nostalgic, and he's full of memories. And so we see, secondly, the desertion. Paul remembers people's names and their faces, and he calls to mind the heartaches and the blessings, the valleys and the mountains. 2 Timothy is a letter that is just dripping with feelings of being deserted. And yet he's undaunted, because in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 17, "But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, so that the message might be preached fully through me, that all the Gentiles might hear. And I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. And the Lord will deliver me from every evil work and preserve me for His heavenly kingdom." And so in this time of confinement, he's longing to be with close friends. And that's why he tells Timothy in this letter to come before winter. The cold winter wind would blow into that dungeon, and he longed to have his friend there before winter. And Paul was also lonely because he said, "Only Luke is with me." And some, like Timothy, were away preaching the gospel in other places. And to add to his loneliness, some had even deserted him. He said, "For Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world." And then some of his influential friends that he was counting on to testify on his behalf before Nero, men of importance, men of standing who would have had some influence with the court and with Nero, failed to do so. They forsook Paul. And that's what Paul meant here in verse 16. "At my first offense, no one..." He's not saying that there weren't any Christians that wouldn't have stood up for him. He's talking about those influential Christians that could have had a bearing on the verdict that he's going to receive. So he said, "These influential friends, none of them stood by me, but all forsook me. May it not be charged against them." In other words, they played it safe to save themselves. I love that magazine article one time. They asked for the readers for a definition of a friend. And the best one they found was this one: "A friend is one who comes in when the whole world has gone out." But I want you to see the distress in our next point. We have all had the pain of someone we trusted having turned away from us. The Asians were men like that in Paul's life. He says in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 15, "You know that everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me." You ever feel deserted at times? Compare yourself with the Apostle Paul, where he looked at a group of Christians and he said, "I can't name one who is still with me." Well, what a distress that must have been to the Apostle Paul. And with extra candor, he gives the names of Phygellus and Hermogenes. And so he talks about them, that they're included in that group. I don't think he said that with any bitterness. I think Paul has come to terms with this. But and also along with this, there was Alexander the coppersmith, who did him much harm. And so they all made his life miserable there in that dungeon. You ever had people turn on you? You ever had someone who was close alongside of you in your life, and it seemed as though they would be there forever, but then through a series of events, they turn away from you? I tell you, that hurts. If you've never had that happen to you, I'm telling you, at some point in your life, it will happen to you. And sometimes we wonder why, but in this old sinful world, that there are those that make life a crushing, distressing experience for us. And it doesn't bother them at all, but it bothers us. And so we think, how should we cope with such a heartache? Well, I'll tell you, we have to live above that, and we've got to get beyond them. We cannot let them drag us down. I really have no easy answers about this question, because I'm still trying to find the answers myself and some that have deserted me and forsaken me in various aspects. But the point is, we have to go on. We must go on. And here is this good man, the Apostle Paul, this great apostle. And at the end of his life, he's remembering a couple of them by name that brought him so much distress. But so different from us, While Paul remembers those who deserted him, he calls to mind a man who had been such a dear friend to him and who had been there time and time again, and it helped him get through this difficult time of confinement. And so secondly, I want you to see the delight of companionship. And I want you to see this man, how concerned he was about the Apostle Paul. In chapter 1 and verse 16, he says there, "May the Lord show mercy to the household of Onesiphorus." The name Onesiphorus means profit bringer, advantage, one who benefits another, one who brings help. He's only mentioned twice in the entire New Testament. And he's unknown to us, generally speaking. And yet faithfully and consistently and without any acclamation or applause, he was there. And he was there. And he was there. And he was always lifting up. That word, refresh there, means to brace up or to revive by fresh air. And to illustrate that, think of a stale, hot, stuffy room. And you come into the room and you're already so weary. And so you go over and open a window and you allow a cool, fresh breeze to flow into the sweltering room. And the fresh air as it comes in brings a new surge of energy and strength to you as you feel that cool breeze. Or maybe the refreshment is the feeling when we sit down under a shade tree to rest after a long, hot spell of yard work. And someone brings us a big, tall glass of cold lemonade. And as we sip it, a delightful breeze begins to blow across our sweaty brow. And we sit there and we go, "Ah, what a refreshment. Feel that breeze." And so then we're refreshed. And then we are ready to get back to work with new strength and energy. I wonder, brothers and sisters, is that how those who are suffering among us, is that how they view us as servants of refreshment? I love the way Moffat translates this. He said, "Many a time he braced me up." That there are so many opportunities in our Christian lives to be a bracing friend. But too many of us, instead of refreshing and bracing up others, drain strength from everyone that we meet. By our own self-centered concentration on our own problems, we demand sympathy and attention, and we leave other people tired and depleted, even in very simple, casual contact with us. And then there are others like Onesiphorus who brace people up. He refreshed his friend so that he could carry on with new strength. In the overwhelming heat of his trials, the Apostle Paul found himself revived when this dear saint came his way. I want you to notice something else here. It says that he often refreshed me. And I know I'm nitpicking. I'm nitpicking every word. But by now, Paul's swan song, every word that he writes is significant. Paul is not exaggerating here. He's in a dungeon. Onesiphorus's genuine concern, what was not a one-time thing, it was a continuing concern. You'll notice there, he often refreshed me. And so Onesiphorus prepared himself to refresh Paul because he had been involved not just in this circumstance, but he had been involved in helping others long before he came to Rome. You say, where do you get that? In 2 Timothy 1 and verse 18, he says, "You know very well in how many ways he helped me in Ephesus." Onesiphorus was consistently doing good, whether it be at home in Ephesus or whether it was away from home in Rome. He had a lifestyle of service, and that's what we're talking about, the lifestyle of a disciple. Onesiphorus gives us this point about a lifestyle of service. He didn't wait for a phone call from a person in need. He was simply there, in many ways showing concern for Paul as he was in need. But I want you to see, secondly, the comfort. You know there are some people who make you squirm and feel uneasy when you're around them. They're hard to be with. And you find yourself thinking, I hope they're not in that group tonight. And you're looking at me right now like I'm the only person who's ever thought that way. But I know you think that way too. Some people make us feel uneasy. They make us churn inside. I heard about one person who went to the library and came across Will Rogers' statement, "I never met a man I didn't like." And someone had written on the book, "You never met my husband." Well, there are some people we just don't like. Onesiphorus is the opposite. You couldn't help but love him. Onesiphorus took away the pain from Paul by refreshing him. He helped him forget about all those deserters. He cooled him off and he revived him. I want you to see, thirdly, the commitment. Chapter 1 of verse 18. He said, "He was not ashamed of my chains." And so you see here that others were ashamed and afraid to admit that they knew the Apostle Paul because it would endanger them, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But Onesiphorus didn't worry about that. Onesiphorus associated with Paul's sufferings, even though it was extremely dangerous. You say, why was it so dangerous? Remember who's on the throne. The madman Nero is on the Roman throne. And he's sitting there in imperial purple. And he took delight in putting pitch on Christians. And he burned them alive for lights in his garden. Or he would take them to the arena to be devoured by wild lions. And sometimes he would sew them up in the skins of animals. And then he would release the wild dogs to drive them mad before the dogs tore them to pieces. The persecutions of Nero against Christians were raging bitterly in this time period. And if you even profess to be a Christian, let alone try to associate yourself with a Christian who had been taken prisoner, you were putting yourself at great risk. But not only did Onesiphorus put himself at great risk, he put his family at great risk. Because in chapter 4, verse 19, the household of Onesiphorus. He was endangering their lives as well, because the persecutions were not just there in Rome, they were throughout the Roman Empire. But like the Good Samaritan, Onesiphorus accepted the risk involved in order to meet the needs of the Apostle Paul. You see, being the Lord's servant, and Michael, I appreciate so much you leading that song. I was thinking about that song in my mind. I thought that'd be a good song to lead. And you led it. So there must be telepathy here or something. I don't know. But anyway, Onesiphorus accepted the risk involved in order to meet the needs of his brother. Being the Lord's servant means being so committed to others that we're willing to move outside of our comfort zone to help someone else. Are we ashamed of another's chains? Do chains frighten us? Everyone has chains. Someone fails and the chain of embarrassment manacles them. They need us. Someone's mate has cheated on them and there's a divorce and the chain of rejection has driven them almost insane. They need us. Someone has been the target of unjust criticism. They're humiliated, that they're wearing the chains of misunderstanding. Someone has the chains of terminal illness. At moments like that, the service of refreshment is absolutely vital if they're going to survive. Onesiphorus was so committed to refreshing Paul that in chapter 1 and verse 17, it says, "On the contrary, when he was in Rome..." My translation in the New King James Version says, "He very zealously searched for me." This translation said, "He searched hard for me until he found me." It was not an easy task to cut through all the red tape in order to visit Paul in prison. It took tenacity, but at last Onesiphorus found him. Someone says, well, why was it so difficult to discover the prison in which Paul was confined? It was because there were many prisons in Rome. And maybe the persecuted Christians were not eager to disclose to this stranger, Onesiphorus from Ephesus. Maybe they were afraid to tell him the location for fear that it might rebound on them and get them in trouble. But Onesiphorus, he was tenacious. And he finally found the prison where Paul was. And even after he found the prison, it may not have been easy for him to gain immediate access to Paul. But he often refreshed Paul So that tells me that he visited Paul more than once. Others were afraid of visiting, but Onesiphorus was committed to Paul's needs. Onesiphorus zealously sought Paul, which means he had to overcome obstacles. As he was winding his way through the maze of prisons in the capital city of the empire, it would have been very easy to give up. This is too difficult. I've already invested several days looking for him. He's nowhere to be found. But in spite of the difficulty and the danger, Onesiphorus persevered. Would we have gone to all that trouble? Do we love anyone that much? Is there someone maybe that we need to hunt up and cheer? To be used by God to refresh others means that sometimes we have to go the extra mile. It may not be easy. It may not be convenient. It may take persistent effort and personal sacrifice. Onesiphorus was willing to pay the price. I think too often we wait for others to approach us for help. But it seems like to me, if we're going to live the lifestyle of a disciple, that we need to be more aggressive in seeking out people and helping them in their need. Let me tell you, we have the attitude of Onesiphorus. When we diligently seek people that are in need, we'll find them. That there are many who need our help, many who need our love. Can't you just picture the Apostle Paul, stranded and abandoned, as they lower Onesiphorus into the dungeon cell? With chains and shackles, he rose to greet his beloved benefactor. And yes, his body was still bound, but now his spirit is free because his dear friend Onesiphorus has appeared to visit him. For the moment, the painful memories of Phygellus and Hermogenes and Demas who forsook him are forgotten as he drinks in the love of Onesiphorus. And because he was so persistent in seeking to be a comfort to Paul, Onesiphorus is known in the Bible as the great refresher. Shouldn't we also be persistent and proactive in seeking to help others so that we can be the great refresher for the Lord? I tell you, the longer I live, the more I appreciate the service of refreshment in the lives of so many Christians. Yes, there's some deserters, and as I talked about last night, we focus on them, but we need to focus on the refreshers so that we can encourage one another and all join together and carry out the Lord's work. In the ancient Roman prisons, I don't think we appreciate this. In the ancient Roman prisons, Rome did not provide food for the prisoners. If a prisoner was to eat, food had to be brought in by a family member or by the mercy of someone else. Since chapter 1 and verse 16 says that Onesiphorus often refreshed me, not only did he refresh him by encouraging him, but I get the idea that Onesiphorus also sustained Paul's life by bringing him food and drink. Remember I said when you went for a visit, you'd be let down into the dungeon by a rope, and the visitor would only leave at the pleasure of the guards. And if you've never had that experience, let me tell you my experience. In Claremont, outside of Claremont, we have a maximum security prison. The worst of the worst go there. And from time to time, people will write me a letter, call me on the phone. I have so-and-so in the prison. Would you go visit him? And one time, Brother Payne, he was in his 90s at the time. We went together and we went in the prison. I want to tell you, when they open that gate and you step inside, that gate closes behind you, that is an eerie feeling. Am I going to get out of here? Get out of here alive? It's a very, very eerie. Can you imagine coming down through that hole? And not knowing if the guards were going to let you come up out of that dungeon again. And in these dungeons, the lighting was poor. Primarily, it came from torches or oil lamps. So the cell would be dark. And you can imagine the unbearable cold and the lack of water and the cramped quarters and the sickening stench from no toilets being in there, which would make sleeping difficult and the waking hours miserable. These prisons were dark. They were disease-ridden. They were overcrowded places. It was common for prisoners to die in custody, either from disease or starvation or brutal torture, execution, or more likely suicide, because they just couldn't cope with it. Imprisonment is commonly described by writers as a fate that was worse than death. Even the thought of it was appalling. And so Onesiphorus agrees to be lowered into this dungeon. He provided food and clothing and bedding and water, may have changed the bedding straw, cleaned away the human waste. What a refreshing servant Onesiphorus was. Just like Jesus said in Matthew chapter 25, He said, "I was a stranger, you did not invite me in, and in prison, and you did not visit me." The Greek word there is a compound Greek word, episkopeo, and it breaks down like this: epi, upon, intensifying already the existing idea in the verb, and skopeo, which means a microscope or a telescope. It's where we get our word scope from. It has the idea of one who looks over closely or intently, who views carefully to examine the state or the affairs of someone else. Visiting meant more than just spending time with the prisoners. It's the idea of showing practical care for those who are in jail and acting as you closely observe their needs. The only way that can practically be done is the way Paul said in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 3, "Remember those who are in prison as though in prison with them, and those who are ministered and mistreated, since you yourself also are in the body." So we've seen the difficulty of the confinement. We've seen the delight of companionship. But then finally, I want you to see the decision to care. Have you ever noticed it's the timing of a thoughtful act rather than the scope of it that makes the difference? When does a glass of iced tea taste best? It's when you're really hot and thirsty. It really hits the spot in the time of need. An act of kindness may seem small and insignificant to us, but if it's done at the right time, it means a whole lot to the person in need. It hits the spot. Onesiphorus was a refresher who hit the spot. How was Onesiphorus able to refresh Paul so that he hit the spot or met the need of the hour? Maybe it was just by his very presence, which implied self-sacrifice and love, especially in those adverse circumstances that we've looked at this evening. So sometimes I think we underestimate the refreshment our personal presence can bring to the sufferer. If nothing else, it takes away the loneliness of the hour. Maybe Onesiphorus brought news to the Apostle Paul concerning individual Christians and churches. Maybe he reminded Paul of God's promises. Not that Paul didn't know those promises, but doesn't it help sometimes when we're going through a difficult time, when someone reminds us of the promises of God? We get weary. We battle Satan. We're busy doing good deeds. That there's so much to do. There are so many people to help. That the prayer list is long. The load we carry can tire us out. Our spirits need refreshing. And when the timing is right and someone comes and refreshes us, what a delight that is. We talk about preachers. I was telling Jeff that sometimes when I go away from Claremont, I remind the brethren, if the preacher is a good preacher, he deserves a 2-week vacation. If he's a bad preacher, the church deserves a 2-week vacation. So he said he's going to be gone next week. So you're getting a 2-week vacation. I'll let Jeff figure that out. But you know, Jeff, he's always energized. He's always pumped up. Most members of the church don't understand those secret times, those private times, behind the scenes, when preachers sometimes get overwhelmed and lay discouraged. They need encouragement. They need their spirits refreshed. Paul did. The refreshing may be a timely letter or card. It always means so much. I've gotten them over the years I've been at Claremont. And when I get them, I think, I didn't know they felt that way about me. And it just makes me feel so good. And then the elders, I mean, they work with so many problems. And they can't tell other people the problems because most of the time, it's in the area of confidentiality. Their work is too often thankless. And sometimes you may see the elders come in and their eyes look weary. They need refreshing. The elderly person in the nursing home or in the hospital or in their home. A card, a call, or a visit could be the highlight of the week. A college student feeling pressured and homesick. It might be the offer to take him out to a meal. Or as some of you did recently, have all the college kids over to your house and show them your care and your concern of them. Maybe the frustrated deacon who is in charge of finding Bible class teachers. It might be an offer to fill in wherever you might be needed. I think at the top of the list is a sick mother. Don't ever say to a sick mother, if there's anything I can do, just call me. Instead, offer specifics. Would tomorrow be a good day to come over and clean the house for you? Or I'm going to pick up some bread and butter and milk and eggs. What else do you need? Or, and I'm sure you do this here, the ladies get together, they put a list up and people sign up. I'll take dinner tonight, you take it tomorrow night. And also be sensitive to the real needs of the one who is suffering. It's a myth that a suffering person constantly needs company every day. So before you go by to visit, ask them, be honest, would you like to see me today or would you rather me wait till tomorrow or maybe sometime later in the week? And please, please don't go into long dissertations of how you've suffered the same thing and the sufferer doesn't have nearly as bad as you had it. What's wrong with listening and simply saying, I'm praying for you. How sweet and comforting that is to the sufferer. You know, suffering takes on many forms, from emotional pain and loneliness to depression and death and destruction. But the sufferer can see the light at the end of the tunnel when we, in a very sensitive way, like Onesiphorus, seek his welfare. Refreshing others is nothing more than old-fashioned encouragement. Everyone needs some encouragement. It's like oxygen to the soul. There are some people that are great at encouraging. I think of that man in the book of Acts who was great at encouraging. His name was called Joseph. That doesn't ring a bell with you, does it? In Acts 4, the apostles gave him a nickname. Barnabas, son of encouragement. Wouldn't you like to be known as a son or a daughter of encouragement? People like Barnabas and Onesiphorus, they have a knack for knowing what to say and how to say it. That they're kind and they're generous. That they have a way of spotting a person when they're having a tough day. That they're easy to talk with. That they're good at what they've done, what they do. And they've done it so long that they don't even think about it. It's just second nature to be a servant of Jesus Christ. To be a refreshing Christian, like Onesiphorus, requires being alert to the needs of others and seeking to provide relief from the pressures that burden them. Let me ask you something. Do you know any Christians that fit the following descriptions? In unfamiliar surroundings, feeling tired and weary, lonely and wondering if anyone cares, experiencing disappointment or discouragement, uncertain about the future, facing extra pressures, difficulties, or limitations? Do you know anybody like that? If you do, then you've identified one who is in need. Could it be possible that God wants to use a human instrument, an Onesiphorus, to serve them? Might He want to use you or me? But sometimes we hold back because when we refresh like Onesiphorus, it seems like we're getting no reward for that and that no one is watching. But God notices. One of my favorite verses is Hebrews 6 and verse 10. And I love the way the New Living Translation translates it. For God is not unjust. He will not forget how hard you have worked for Him. and how you have shown your love to him by caring for other believers as you still do. Sounds like Onesiphorus. Consistently, as you still do. And when we do help the sufferer, even though he may not be able to reward us out of his own means, the Lord can. Paul would never be able to repay Onesiphorus for the mercy Onesiphorus had shown him. So you know what Paul did? He said, may the Lord grant that he will find mercy from the Lord on that day. Brethren, when others have helped us, shouldn't we, like Paul, out of gratitude, pray for God's mercy upon them in that last day? And as the Apostle Paul follows Onesiphorus into the next world, knowing that God's mercy is so vast and so wonderful, he looks forward to being reunited with his brother. And I think when we look in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 8, when Paul said, there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also for all, including Onesiphorus, who have longed for his appearing. My friend, if you're going to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, and you find yourself caught up in your own needs and your own burdens, may I suggest to you that what you need is to become a servant of refreshment. Start giving yourself away. Stop spending your day looking within and licking your own wounds and feeling sorrow for your plight. Roll up your sleeves on tomorrow's dawn and determine that from this day on, I'm going to give myself away. That I'm going to find one person this week who needs a word of refreshment, and I will give it without restraint. You know what happens when you do that? By the end of your life, you're going to have a list of people who, when they write their last words, will name you among their most precious, precious group of friends. Refreshing Christians. Let's just do it. Serving is what Christianity is all about. If you've been serving self and it's led to public sin in your life, then you need to repent of that. If you've never become a Christian by being baptized into Jesus Christ, you need to do that so that you can be a part of this great company of refreshers and be in heaven for all eternity. How would you like the Bible to write your biography in one sentence? We've just read about Onesiphorus in a very short description. Do you, like him, seek out those in need to give a refreshment to them? Do you serve unselfishly, no matter what the cost? And it does cost. I want to tell you a story that I found years ago. It's very touching. And after we do this story, we'll sing the invitation song. There was a man by the name of Jeff McMullen. And Jeff had spent 4 years playing the character of Ronald McDonald in Arizona and Southern California for the McDonald's Corporation. On Ronald Day, once a month, Ronald McDonald's would visit as many of the community hospitals as possible, bringing a little happiness into a place where no one ever looks forward to going. The visits make a difference for the children and the adults who are experiencing a downtime. Jeff said that the warmth and the gratification he received in return stayed with him for weeks. Everybody loved the project. There are two restrictions placed on Ronald McDonald's. First, they must be accompanied on their visits by both McDonald's personnel and hospital personnel. That way, if they walk into the room and they frighten a child, that there would be someone to address that issue immediately. Secondly, they are not to physically touch anyone within the hospital. The hospital authorities didn't want germs transferred from one patient to the other. And Jeff understood why they had this don't touch rule, but he didn't like it. Breaking either one of these rules, he was told, meant that he could lose his job. Toward the end of his fourth year of Ronald Days, as he was heading down the hallway on his way home, Jeff heard a little voice, "Ronald, Ronald." And he stopped. And he knew the soft little voice was coming through a half-open door. And so he opened the door and he saw a young boy, about 5 years old, lying in his dad's arms, hooked up to more medical equipment than Jeff had ever seen before. Mom was on the other side with Grandma and Grandpa, and there was a nurse tending the equipment. McMullen knew from the feeling in the room that the situation was grave. He asked the little boy his name, and he said, "My name is Billy." And Jeff did a few magical tricks for Billy. And as he stepped to say goodbye, Jeff asked Billy if there's anything else he could do. And he said, "Ronald, would you hold me?" It was such a simple request. But what ran through Jeff's mind was that if he touched Billy, he could lose his job. So he told Billy he could not do that right now. But he suggested that the two of them could draw a picture together. Upon completing the picture, Billy again asked McMullen to hold him. And by this time, Jeff's heart was crying out, "Yes." But his mind was screaming, "No, you're going to lose your job." The second time that Billy asked, Jeff had to ponder why he could not grant the simple request of a little boy who probably would not be going home. "Hold me." It was such a simple request. And yet Jeff searched for any reasonable response that would allow him to leave. He couldn't find one, except that if he lost his job, he'd lose his car and he'd lose his home eventually. But still, he finally decided he could not pass up the opportunity to bring happiness to a dying boy. And so he sent Mom and Dad and Grandma and Grandpa out of the room. He sent his two McDonald's escorts out to the van. And the nurse tending the medical equipment stayed in the room, but Jeff asked her to turn and face the corner. And then he picked up that little wonder of a human being. And Jeff said Billy was so scared and so frail. And they laughed and they cried for 45 minutes. And they talked about all the things that worried him. Billy, one of his worries was his little brother might get lost coming home from kindergarten next year because Billy wouldn't be there to show him the way. And he worried that his dog wouldn't get another bone because Billy had hidden the bones in the house before going to the hospital. And now he couldn't remember where he'd put the bones. These are problems to a little boy who knows he's not going home. On his way out of the room, with tear-streaked makeup going down his neck, Jeff gave Billy's mom and dad his real name and phone number, another automatic dismissal for Ronald McDonald. And he said if there's anything the McDonald's Corporation or he could do, to just give him a call and consider it done. Less than 48 hours later, he received a phone call from Billy's mom. She informed him that Billy had passed away. And she and her husband just wanted to thank Jeff for making a difference in the little boy's life. And the mother told Jeff that shortly after he left the room, that Billy looked at her and said, "Mama, I don't care if I see Santa this year because I was held by Ronald McDonald." And I thought, here's a man that wasn't even a Christian. And he was really willing to risk and to pay the cost. Brothers and sisters, as disciples of Jesus Christ, we've got to be willing to pay the cost and to be a refresher like Onesiphorus was. Whatever your spiritual need, won't you come as we stand and as we sing.